It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, cooperative witnesses are a key part of solving violent crimes, but fear and violence can prevent people from sharing what they know. We'll take a close look at one deadly case of witness intimidation in Milwaukee and how investigators are fighting the wider problem.
First, Hurricane Harvey is expected to be the strongest storm in the last 12 years. Right now, it's building up in the warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico and is expected to make an overnight landfall near Corpus Christi, Texas.
With the storm gaining strength through the day, millions of people are at risk and many communities have ordered evacuations.
Jonathan Erdman is a senior meteorologist at weather.com, and he joins us to look at what lies ahead for people living in the hurricane's path. Jonathan, welcome to Central Time.
Veronica, Rob, it's great to talk to you. I wish under better circumstances, though.
That's right. And it's still early, but Hurricane Harvey is predicted to be the worst storm in over a decade. Jonathan, can you put that into context for us?
Yeah, well, right now, Harvey is only about 70 miles off the coast of Texas, off of Corpus Christi. And as you mentioned earlier, it is going to make a landfall during the overnight hours tonight. And when we just look at hurricane landfalls in that area of Texas known as the Coastal Bend, if you look at a map of Texas, that's where the coast bends to the south. This will be their strongest landfall since 1970 when Hurricane Celia devastated Corpus Christi in that area. So they're bracing for something that many, unless you're a longtime resident there, they have probably never lived through something like this before.
And this hurricane, Hurricane Harvey, just got bumped up to a Category 3. It was hovering right at the edge of 2. Now it's a 3. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it just means that the winds in its eyewall, which is the circular ring of most vigorous thunderstorms surrounding the eye, have gotten a bit stronger. But the difference between a Category 2 and a Category 3 really isn't that much in the grand scheme of things. Because basically we're expecting a life-threatening storm surge of 6 to 12 feet, above normal high tide levels at the coast as the eye comes ashore. And then really the more significant big threat coming forward is actually just some incredibly epic rainfall totals that will last all the way through much of next week.
Any chance that this hurricane could strengthen and maybe hit Category 4?
Well, we can't really rule that out. We've had some cases of what are called rapid intensification, where storms will just intensify so quickly within the span of a few hours. We can't rule that out yet, but again, it'll be, whether it's a Category 3 or 2 or 4, it'll still be a very intense hurricane when it comes and makes landfall tonight.
And on the flip side, is there a chance still that this storm could dissipate, could kind of peter out before it makes landfall?
Well, it's not going to dissipate before it reaches landfall, and one of the problems with this particular storm is that, sometimes you have hurricanes that make landfall and they quickly sweep away. The problem with this particular hurricane is it's going to make landfall, and then the steering winds in the atmosphere are basically going to collapse, and as a result, it's going to stall out over this general area of southeast Texas near the coastal bend. It could stall out for 3, 4, 5 days or longer in the next week, and when that happens, It's a terrible rainfall flood scenario.
Right. I've heard that phrase, stalling out. How is it possible you could have a weather front like that, in this case a storm, just kind of hover there, sit there on land for that long?
Yeah. Hurricanes are just merely directed by large-scale features in the atmosphere, so areas of high pressure to the east of it, or in this case, an area of high pressures to the west of it. Sometimes, though, there are cases where there's just no steering winds in the atmosphere at all. So the winds that steered Harvey toward the Texas coast eventually will basically collapse. And so when that happens, it's like you're driving a car. If the car is Harvey and you're the atmosphere, and you take your foot off the gas pedal, eventually your car is going to come to a stop. Yeah, if it's on a flat road. And that's the truly scary part about this, is that we could be dealing with Harvey all the way through this time next week, still producing torrential rain in parts of Texas.
So torrential rain, I've seen forecasts in the 30s of inches. So are we talking about flooding here is almost a certainty?
Yeah, and unfortunately, this has happened before in Texas. We had Tropical Storm Allison 16 years ago, which was a billion-dollar flood event, one of the worst on record in Houston. And it's also happened in 1979 with Tropical Storm Claudette. You know, just to put this amount of rainfall into perspective, if you look at Milwaukee's average annual rainfall precipitation, so rain and melted snow, it's about 34 to 35 inches. So parts of Texas are going to see roughly the average annual precipitation that Milwaukee gets in just maybe 5 or 6 days. Hmm. And when that happens, it's just they're just nowhere for the water to go.
Jonathan Erdman is with us right now. He's a senior meteorologist at weather.com looking at Hurricane Harvey, which is predicted to be one of the most serious hurricanes in more than a decade. And the governor of Texas, Governor Abbott, has declared a state of disaster for 30 counties. How do communities brace for something like this? What does that state of disaster declaration do to galvanize forces into action?
Well, it's an interesting question, Veronica. You know, usually the saying in weather that we have regarding hurricanes is run from the water and hide from the wind. And what that means is usually with hurricanes, the storm surge is the most dangerous part. The storm surge is that water rise when the water gets pushed from the ocean toward the coast. And that's why we always tell people to evacuate from the coast to get away from that storm surge, which in this case could be 6 to 12 feet high. You know, an average person is, what, 5.5, 6 feet tall. So imagine 6 to 12 feet of water outside your front door. You can see why you'd want to evacuate people. In this particular instance, it's a very perplexing case because there are parts of Texas well inland from the coast that could see 30 to 40 inches of rain or even more. And so we're talking about record flooding in some areas. And, you know, frankly, if I lived 3 or 4 counties away from the coast and you told me I was going to get 30 to 40 inches of rain, I wouldn't want to be there. I'd want to get out too. So this is going to be a disaster of possibly historic proportions for parts of Southeast Texas because of all that lingering flooding that could persist for days, if not weeks.
What is the situation like right now on the roads in Texas along the coast? Are people trying to get out and running into traffic jams and maybe gas prices going up, that kind of thing?
Well, I have seen reports of gas prices that have gone up, and that's always a concern anytime you have a Gulf Coast hurricane because of all the oil rigs out there and the number of refineries that have to adjust their operations or completely shut down. You know, fortunately, it looks like there's been a pretty orderly evacuation out of the evacuated areas, generally north and east of Corpus Christi. So that pretty much has been done. It looks like, you know, I haven't seen too many jammed up roads. Nothing like what we saw in 2005 with Hurricane Rita. If you remember, Houston had a total nightmare on the roads due to basically the entire city just said, okay, we need to evacuate, get out of the way. But then Rita didn't hit Houston, it actually hit Louisiana. And there were people, there was gridlock, you know, stranded in 100-degree heat. I haven't seen anything like that so far. Of course, it's hit a less populated area for now. But, you know, hopefully everybody's gotten away from the coast that needs to be. If they haven't gotten away yet, they really need to hunker down now.
Now, you mentioned that the last time this area has seen a storm of this potential magnitude was in the 70s with Hurricane Celia, I think you said it was. Are there any lessons that the Corpus Christi area can look at and learn from for this storm, this hurricane that's coming?
Well, the lessons learned is you know, you have to take it seriously. You can't really ride this thing out. You know, obviously, I mentioned the storm surge earlier at the coast. You want to get people away from the coast. And unfortunately, I have seen some, you know, some reports of people refusing to evacuate even in a mandatory zone. And, you know, that just, you know, I get a pit in my stomach when I hear about that because you just can't ride this storm out. You're taking your life into your hands. What happened with Celia is the winds were so intense that there was widespread damage in the city of Corpus Christi. There was a lot of structural damage, a lot of homes, a lot of residences. There was damage to 2 hangars at the Corpus Christi Airport, and that was from the eyewall of the storm, too. So, you know, I think the lessons learned, there are multiple hazards with this. There's rainfall flooding, there's storm surge flooding at the coast, and then there's damaging winds in the eyewall. So, really, you need to take every hurricane, especially one this intense, very seriously and strongly consider evacuation.
Now, Hurricane Katrina was a major test for the Bush administration. In a couple words, what are you looking for from the Trump administration?
Well, I hope they, I hope all the resources are put into place. This is, as we've, what we learned from Katrina and, recent hurricanes is that it isn't just an event that occurs near landfall or even the day after. The aftermath can last for days, weeks, and even months. In fact, I just had a meteorologist friend of mine send me something on Twitter this morning that said there are still parts of North Carolina that haven't recovered from Matthew, and that was last October.
And we leave it there. Jonathan, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com.
Coming up, witness intimidation is a big problem for the criminal justice system in Milwaukee. We'll look at a shocking case and how police and prosecutors are trying to turn things around. This is Central Time. Now, for police investigating gun violence, an eyewitness can be the difference between a conviction and a crime going unsolved. But fear of retaliation can keep people from sharing what they know.
In 2015, Antonio Smith spent months trying to silence the people who saw him murder Eddie Poe in Milwaukee's Garden Homes neighborhood. The case is the subject of a six-part series in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel called The Intimidator. It wraps up today, and you can find it linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Ashley Lutheran reports on crime and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's a co-author of the series. Ashley, thanks for joining us.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, it turns out witness intimidation, a big issue, a big story in Milwaukee, and it sounds like police and prosecutors are just starting to devote more resources to it. Do we know how common, first of all, witness intimidation is?
So witness intimidation is hard to measure. The metric my colleague John and I used was looking at the number of specific witness intimidation charges that have been filed. We looked at snapshots in time from 2005 to 2015, which mirrors a couple of the time elements in our series as we're focusing on one very egregious and serious case of witness intimidation. Prosecutors here in Milwaukee County have devoted many resources to witness intimidation. The struggle is just the volume and scope is overwhelming at times.
And in this case, you write about the case of Antonio Smith. Intimidation isn't a strong enough word. I mean, witnesses are murdered in the course of this ongoing case. But can you sum up the story of Antonio Smith and his actions after a 2015 murder?
Sure. So as you mentioned, there was a murder in 2015. Antonio Smith is suspected of that and ultimately is charged with that homicide. 8 days after that killing in July in Milwaukee's Garden Home neighborhoods, a 17-year-old witness to that first homicide is gunned down. It's an ambush situation. I should point out, in retrospect, it seems very clear that these two things were connected, but at the time, investigators weren't exactly sure if they were directly related. They later determined, yes, they were. And then, after Antonio Smith is behind bars, he works with other individuals, other accomplices that he has who are still out on the streets, to try to kill another witness to that first homicide in Garden Homes.
And in addition to actual homicide, it sounds like in this case and others, there are threats made, texts, verbal threats maybe, saying if you talk, you or in some cases your family are in danger.
Yes, and we've seen this in many high-profile cases here in Milwaukee. And most of the time, witness intimidation is a lot more subtle than what took place in this. As you said, it's not just intimidation, it's murder. And what we see is that frequently in cases that involve gangs or drug-related violence, and also domestic violence. Those are cases that often involve witness intimidation because a lot of that requires people to come to court and testify about what someone did.
And the slang phrase, the catchphrase people use, you write, is no face, no case. So without key witnesses, somebody can literally get away with murder.
It can be very difficult for prosecutors and police to make sure that individuals are held accountable in a court of law if they don't have witnesses to come forward. The criminal justice system is set up so that people accused of crimes can confront those who are accusing them and can confront and address the evidence brought against them. And that is a fundamental part of our system of law here. It does create challenges and it does create... It can create opportunity for individuals to try to manipulate the system. And so what prosecutors are trying to do is be more aggressive in how they're prosecuting it. They're targeting high-risk cases that they've identified because of those other factors that I mentioned earlier, and they're trying to intervene. So sometimes if a person ultimately is acquitted of the original offense, let's say a domestic violence battery, they might then still be convicted of intimidating the witness in that same case.
And this intimidation goes on sometimes even right there in the courtroom, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when we were covering this particular case involving Antonio Smith, there were many deputies and DA office investigators there monitoring the crowd and monitoring the people who were taking the stand and the defendant, Antonio Smith, watching for any kind of motion or gesture or look. You know, it's as simple as, you know, the classic mean mugging. But that all is an intimidating thing because, to be very honest, it's hard for someone's safety to be guaranteed. You'll see in our piece, you know, someone's safety was guaranteed by basically being moved to another county and put behind bars himself.
We're talking to Ashley Lutheran from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, co-author of a series on witness intimidation. We've got a link to that series on the Central Time Facebook page. Ashley, one of the most shocking episodes of many in the story you tell about Antonio Smith, as you mentioned, behind bars, he is conspiring to silence witnesses, and a conspiracy basically between him behind bars, his girlfriend and others to try to kill one of the witnesses. Police find out about this. Can you talk about that story?
Absolutely. So jail staffers are monitoring the calls of Antonio Smith. He tries some tactics to make to throw them off his scent, or he hopes that he has. But they're listening in. They're watching and recording all of these things. And he makes a plot and hires, you know, essentially hires a hitman to try to kill another witness. And he does that from behind bars with the video and telephone calls. And his girlfriend, pregnant girlfriend, who's still out running his drug dealing operation, is the key conduit between that. And so she's meeting up with this hitman that Antonio Smith has hired, and then they go to try to bail out this witness out of jail who is locked up for a different offense. And their plan was to bail him out and kill him. And investigators heard this plot. They were able to disrupt it. It was very urgent, very time-sensitive. They picked up the witness from the House of Correction here, which is a low-security facility out in a Milwaukee suburb. And they explained, hey, this is a very real threat against your life. This is what we're going to do. And it was to the point where Antonio Smith's girlfriend and the man he had hired were actually going around the courthouse complex here in Milwaukee looking for this witness, because they knew he would have to go there when he was released on bail that they had posted.
And then they lose track of this witness, and then there's a plot, I believe fortunately never carried out, to potentially firebomb a house where they think the witness is staying,
yes,
and then shoot people as they run out of the building.
Yes. They originally think, you know, while this is all going on, Antonio Smith is still making calls from the county jail to his girlfriend. He's telling her, you know where you need to be, when she says she can't find this witness in the courthouse complex. They go to the house where they think this witness might be. Maybe he was already released. Maybe he's already there. They think we're going to do an armed home invasion, but then they decide that's too risky. So they decide, yes, we're going to try to firebomb this house, and as people flee, we're going to shoot at them. Now, that was interrupted because they circled that area so frequently and in such a short amount of time that other people in that neighborhood got suspicious and called the police. The police realized what was going on, and there was a short pursuit. They lost the suspects, but then the next day they arrested all three people involved in the plot and searched several residences, including a storage facility as well.
And I want to put this into a little wider context. This is happening, a lot of it, in a circle of people who know each other either directly or by reputation. They may have lived or grown up in the same area. They know who everybody else knows in many cases. It would be hard to come forward and testify against someone in those circumstances when everybody knows who everybody else is.
Absolutely. As we know, violence, particularly gun violence, is highly concentrated, and it's concentrated among tight networks of people. And that is the case here with Antonio Smith. And one of the great tragedies and ironies of this is that the 17-year-old witness, Brianna Eskridge, who was shot and killed, she was interviewed by police, but she did not provide information identifying Antonio Smith as the shooter. But to Antonio Smith, the fact that she had talked and he knew that she had talked and, you know, whether he believed that she had provided that information, he at least knew that she had been interviewed. And to him, that was enough to make her a problem for him.
This story was all going on, all starting the initial murder and the events that followed in that year 2015, when we were seeing this big jump in homicides in Milwaukee, mostly gun violence. How big a part of that story, this increase in gun violence and efforts to stop it, is this witness intimidation? How big an obstacle is this to getting a handle on that increase in homicides?
I think witness intimidation is sort of an under-accounted for variable in a lot of cases, because you have folks who maybe don't, who want to handle gun violence or victimization by retaliating, by getting their own justice. Maybe they feel that they don't trust the criminal justice system to get them justice or the justice that they're seeking. And they're weighing all of these very real safety concerns as well. So I think it's definitely a factor, and I think it's been an underexplored factor because it's very difficult to quantify. How many times do people not call 911 when they hear gunfire because they know if they do, you know, that might attract suspicion from their neighbors? We can't really measure that sometimes. Sometimes it's hard to measure absence.
Do police and prosecutors feel like they're making headway here with their newer efforts on witness intimidation?
I think so. I think the DA's office, you know, when my colleague John and I reported soon after this case broke in November of 2015, when we were reporting on other efforts around the country, you know, Milwaukee County really is looked at as a model for handling witness intimidation. And by having this very experienced and aggressive unit within the district attorney's office. Again, the question is of the one of volume. You have more than 20,000 phone calls made from the jail every single week, identifying who is the most dangerous and which calls need to be monitored the most, parsing through, understanding, listening to hours of tape. That all takes a lot of time and a lot of resources.
We'll leave it there for now. Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Ashley Lutheran, one of the authors of The Intimidator, a six-part series about witness intimidation in Milwaukee. You can find that series linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We'll look at what makes a top-notch sandwich and how you can upgrade your favorite sandwich recipes. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Food Friday. Today, a look at that one food that's been there for us through grade school, lunch meetings, and more, the sandwich.
Some people might think that they know all there is to know about sandwiches, but there's actually a bit of controversy about what a sandwich actually is. For example, is it a hot dog? Or is it a sandwich that has two slices of bread? Could pizza be a sandwich?
Thankfully, we have someone here to help demystify the sandwich and tell us how to make better ones. Andrew Hutchinson is the owner and head baker at Madison Sourdough, a bakery and patisserie in Madison. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us here in the studio.
Happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, I don't know if there's a definitive answer, but I want to hear your perspective on this. What makes a sandwich a sandwich? Is a wrap a sandwich? Is a hot dog? Where do you draw the line?
I say you need to have at least two. Well, you need to have bread, mm-hmm. And for me as a baker, that's where I would draw the line. I think traditionally a sandwich is, you know, people use it in the context of putting things in the middle, right? Mm-hmm. Sandwich between two pieces of whatever. However, I do think an open-faced sandwich has become part of the regular menu on a number of restaurants, and so I feel that the open-faced sandwich is still a sandwich.
And according to the USDA, a sandwich is a, quote, a meat or poultry filling between two slices of bread, a bun, or a biscuit. It's a technical definition. And we heard yours, in particular here, the fillings. They said meat or poultry filling. Do you have a unified theory of sandwich fillings?
I think you could put anything between two pieces of bread and it's a sandwich.
So do you agree with that definition by and large?
No, because I'm mostly a vegetarian. But
yeah, I have to agree with you there. I thought meat or poultry, what's a cheese sandwich? Like a grilled cheese, which we'll talk later.
Absolutely.
And one thing that I always find is that sandwiches are always better when somebody else makes them. But we can maybe get a little more advanced than that. Since you're an expert in breads in particular, talk about what you look for in the right bread for a sandwich.
I think it depends on the type of sandwich you want to make. You know, a deli sandwich where all the ingredients are cold. I prefer something that's a bread that's a little bit softer, easy to bite through so that you don't push the ingredients out the sides of the sandwich. Whereas a hot sandwich, the bread tends to be crispy yet give a little bit. So I think you have a little bit more, a little more wiggle room there. So a traditional sandwich style loaf of bread, meaning something baked in a pan and it's really uniform, I think works great as a cold sandwich. When I make something that's hot, I really prefer something that's nice and crusty and has a little more interesting texture to it.
It seems like fashions for bread have changed with sandwiches. I've noticed in the last few years that it has been softer bread, whereas I feel like maybe in the early 2000s, it was always really crusty things that tore up the roof of your mouth, which I think maybe is why the change happened. But do you think that was a good thing, or is there still a place for that really kind of craggy bread?
In some circles, I say that when your mouth is getting torn up by the crust of a bread, to me, that's a sign of a good loaf of bread in a way. So I'm a little bit biased towards that. However, you know, if I'm eating a submarine sandwich and it's, you know, on a French style baguette, if the crust is too crispy, too sharp, it's not really all that pleasant to eat. So something softer, but still crisp. You can still make something that's crisp, but has some give. So it's a little bit of a delicate balance, especially on the baking end of things. You know, my experience, 3 minutes too long in the oven is sometimes enough to kind of push it in that dangerous realm, if you will.
It is Food Friday. We're talking about building a better sandwich. Andrew Hutchinson is with us from Madison Sourdough. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. What is your go-to sandwich? What do you pack for the kids at school? What do they like the best? What do you want to give them? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We have some recipes you sent along, and one that I want to try. You've got a great grilled cheese sandwich with you know, my kids like the white bread and singles, Kraft singles type of cheese sandwich. Yours is a little fancier than that.
It is. Definitely a grown-up's grilled cheese, but I think the kids will certainly love it. I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and grilled cheese is my go-to quick meal when I don't have time to cook something more elaborate. But the recipe I have here is just sort of a basic grilled cheese. I think that the key is one, a good loaf of bread, something that has a little bit of chew, a little bit of heft to it, that so that it holds up when you're cooking it. And then the type of cheese you're using. I really like the problem with aged cheeses, they are great on flavor, but they tend to be grainy when you heat them up. And so what you want to do is have a blend of two cheeses, one that's young, a little bit softer, creamier with a higher fat content, and then something that's aged. So you're kind of boosting the flavor with an aged cheese and improving the texture with something that's a little bit younger. So in this recipe, just to kind of fancy it up, you know, an aged cheddar, 2 to 5 years, and then a brie cheese, which is going to give you that really kind of luscious, silky mouthfeel.
And what do you like for the crust when you grill that? So there's different ways you can do this. You can butter the bread itself. I've seen a recipe from Ruth Reichel where she puts mayonnaise on it and then Parmesan cheese, and that's another similar way to go, and lots of different styles. What do you prefer? What's your favorite?
I think just a good quality unsalted butter, and I just butter the outside of the sandwich, and then I just put a little bit of cooking oil or olive oil in the pan just to kind of just for a even heat distribution, and then putting the sandwich directly on that oil, you're going to get a really good crispy sear on the first side. I recommend starting out quite hot and with a pan that holds a lot of heat, such as cast iron. And then when it's nice and brown on the first side, flipping it over, turning the heat down, and and letting it crisp up, but it'll cook a little bit longer, allowing that cheese to really melt and kind of become part of the sandwich.
So brie and aged cheddar. And let's name names when it comes to bread. You said something good, kind of chewy, but like what kind of breads would we be shopping for here?
Well, I'm obviously biased towards Madison sourdough. By and large, when someone asks me about, you know, making a grilled cheese at the farmer's market, I always steer them towards a bread that we make called miche, which translates as mixed. And it's a mixed grain sourdough. It's a blend of locally grown wheats and rye. Has a very rich flavor that goes well with basically all things. And the texture on the bread is really nice. It's got a crust that is quite thin and very dark and crispy, and then the interior is very large. It's actually a loaf of bread that is baked quite large, and we sell it in more or less hunks, and you can buy it in a whole loaf, half loaf, or a quarter loaf. And I just feel like texturally, for me, it is the ideal bread for a grilled cheese sandwich.
I want to talk through another one of your recipes here. It's a pan con tomate. When we're in tomato season now, we're getting these delicious heirloom tomatoes. Walk us through that one. How does that one come together?
Sure. Yeah, this is, you know, when it comes to sandwiches, I like keeping it really simple. This is certainly one that is going to push the definition of a sandwich. It's open face. So this is a kind of a classic plate that you would get in a Spanish tapas bar. And basically, it's a thick cut piece of bread, fried on both sides till it's very crispy in olive oil. And then you take a really nice ripe tomato, you cut it in half, and then you just, the crispiness of the bread acts as a kind of like a microplane or like a grater to the tomato. So as you rub the tomato, the cut side of the tomato on the bread, it kind of creates a sauce, like a pulpy sauce on the slice of bread. I add a little bit of salt to that, and then like a really nice like aged cheese such as like pecorino or manchego to be more traditional. And then if you want to indulge even further, you know, a couple slices of prosciutto or serrano ham, and it's just it's really fabulous, and it'll take you less than 5 minutes to make.
Wow.
I could see that being a great appetizer. On the other end, I could see sitting down and eating enough of those to make a meal. That one could go either way, couldn't it?
Absolutely. One of those, two of those with a, you know, a nice kind of veggie salad is enough to sustain me on any given night for sure.
So it's interesting you use the bread as sort of a microplaner to smush down the tomato and get this sort of sauce. Are there any other similar recipes like that where you use the bread and you kind of rub stuff? I know garlic you can do that with, right? You can kind of get a nice garlic wash over the bread.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that so much, but it, that'd be a really good way for, to make a nice kind of quick garlic bread in a way. You know, just thinking it off the top of my head, but to do the same method with the bread, frying it in olive oil and rubbing it with a fresh clove of garlic would certainly impart a very strong garlic flavor. But then topping that with some nice Parmesan cheese would be, you don't even have to turn your oven on. You can have garlic bread without an oven. So
it's pretty tasty.
And now I'm just in my head, I'm like thinking of all the things I could try. You could try like a banana and like grate it on and then put on some peanut butter. That'd be really good, right? Yeah. I mean, not with the garlic. Or the tomato. It's its own thing.
You know what?
Thing.
Maybe you should leave this to the pros, Rob.
Well, no.
I'm not sure about
tinkering.
This banana sandwich.
It's the great American experiment or spirit of invention.
I'm glad you brought up the peanut butter and banana.
Which is a great combo.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite pieces of toast. So now we're kind of getting this kind of, is it toast?
Right.
Is it sandwich territory? But you can do a lot of things with that same method. So
we're talking with Andrew Hutchinson right now, owner and head baker at Madison Sourdough, about sandwiches for this week's Food Friday.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. How do you define what a sandwich is? Do you have a favorite sandwich that you like to make for a meal, take to work, a pack for school, maybe a favorite picnic sandwich? How do you dress up your sandwiches? What is your favorite condiment for your basic sandwich? I've got a zucchini relish that I put on just about everything. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up the conversation about sandwiches for this week's Food Friday. Andrew Hutchinson, owner and head baker at Madison Sourdough, is telling us how we can up our sandwich game.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is the best sandwich you've ever eaten? What is the best sandwich you ever made? What is your secret to a great sandwich? Or do you have questions? You make it yourself. It's not so good. It's missing something. Maybe our guest can help you out with some inspiration. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Find some recipes while you're there.
And we'll go to our callers. Now we've got Stephen on the line first, joining us from Madison. Stephen, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What do you think?
I was just calling in to say that I make a really simple sandwich, but it's killer every time. And I just roast some vegetables in the oven. So I just turn on the oven, toss them with a little bit of olive oil. It'll be peppers, onions, maybe the squash or zucchini if I have something like that. Throw some garlic cloves on there. And I just roast it for 20 minutes, and then I put it on a really crusty baguette. Sometimes I'll mix a little bit of cream cheese with, like, if I have some roasted red pepper or something like that, and it's just a delicious sandwich.
It does sound really good. Roasted veggies on a sandwich. And is this open-faced, Stephen, or do you have the two pieces of baguette?
No, I like it with the – I like doing it almost like a sub sandwich, but it's just the vegetables and cream cheese inside.
Hmm. I like that. I might steal that, Stephen. Thank you for that. What do you think, sandwich expert? Do you like that one?
Yeah, it sounds delicious. In the summertime, I'm always thinking about ways to not heat up my kitchen. Some grilled vegetables as well would be really tasty.
Oh, yeah. Just to get them on a skewer, grill them up, and dice them up and put them on the sandwich.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Stephen. That sounds great. We'll go next to Nancy with us in Madison. Nancy, hi.
Hi. So I have a sandwich that's very odd, but I've been eating it since I was a little girl, and it's peanut butter, cucumber, and mayonnaise.
Yes, I was just talking about this during the break, Nancy. I am on board with you. Peanut butter goes with any kind of sandwich. I do cheese and onion and lettuce. Do you get weird looks like I do when you put this together?
Everybody I tell says, ugh. But
do they try it?
No, but my whole family loves it now, and someone taught it to me when I was about 10, and I've been eating it. I'm older, and I've been eating it, and it's best if you can do it on a good rye bread, too.
Yep. I am so 100% on board, Nancy. You and I are opening up a restaurant and probably closing that restaurant in a couple of months. Thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate that. I mean, there are weirdos out here like me and Nancy, but experimenting with different ingredients can be a lot of fun on sandwiches.
Absolutely. There's the risk is very low, and the reward can be very high.
So, Andrew, what is your kind of out there fringe, you're feeling kind of crazy sandwich?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think I probably stay within the bounds of, you know, what's somewhat normal. But, I mean, I don't know. I'm not really thinking of something really off the top of my head. But, you know, you can – my whole philosophy with a sandwich is not to just – I don't want to put too much on it. Often I might go out to eat and the sandwich has 9 ingredients on it and it's just going to, it becomes sort of a mess.
What about the trend of putting a soft cooked egg on top of whatever sandwich it is? I bet Rob would do that on
all
his peanut butter.
All over that. Yeah. I love it.
I knew it. Do you like the egg trend?
I put a lot of eggs on my grilled cheese sandwiches. Yeah. I think a nice soft cooked egg. I like putting it right in between and cooking it with the sandwich. But I think a fried egg makes a lot of things just taste a little bit better. And also, you know, in my household, it's a really great way to get some protein. So,
right.
Yeah.
We're talking to Andrew Hutchinson, owner and head baker at Madison Sourdough, sharing his love of sandwiches and his advice. We've got some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. Call in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. One more recipe you sent us, Andrew. What to do with the leftover chicken? You've got a chicken salad sandwich. So what's the key to a good chicken salad?
Well, there's some debate whether you want to put like fruit and stuff in your chicken salad. I prefer a chicken salad that's maybe on the slightly sweeter end. So in this recipe, using whatever chicken you have left over after, you know, roast chicken dinner. I like putting diced apples, cranberries, toasted pecans. We actually serve something like this or really similar at our cafe. And, you know, some kind of fresh herb in this recipe, thyme, but it could be, you know, rosemary, oregano, just something to give it a little bit more, you know, a little I don't want to say spicy, but nice herbal element to it. And then a mayonnaise. If you can make your own mayonnaise, I think that's better. But you can certainly pull one out of a jar. So,
oh, that sounds yummy. And again, that recipe with all those others is up on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go now to Brianna in Wausau. Brianna, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I was just calling in because you're talking about sandwiches. And when I was little, my nana used to make me fried egg sandwiches where it was just an egg fried up, put on white bread, and covered in ketchup. And it's still the only way that I can eat them. And my nana's passed on now, but I always get reminded of her when I eat those. Aww. Fried egg sandwiches covered in ketchup.
Yeah, that doesn't sound bad to me. I'm a ketchup lover, too, and with eggs, everything goes. I think everything works there. Less controversial to me than your weird peanut butter sandwiches,
true,
Rob.
True.
Andrew, what about that? A simple fried egg, bread, and ketchup.
Yeah, I think it sounds great. You got your sauce, you got your egg, and the bread, and it's just such a simple sandwich. I love when a food or a dish like that kind of reminds you of, you know, maybe someone who's passed or reminds you of your childhood in a way. So I was just making little egg in a basket sandwiches for my kids the other day, and it was one of the first things I actually learned to cook. Mm-hmm. And it was really fun. So.
Is that like toad in a hole? Egg in a basket?
Yeah, 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 exactly.
You tear the center out of the bread and fry the egg in it? Is that what you're thinking?
Correct, yeah. And then you flip it over and you kind of have like toast and a fried egg.
Yeah, I like making that once in a while. It's hard for me because I don't like the yolk too runny. It's hard for me to get the yolk unrunny. Or do you like the runny yolk?
I like the runny yolk, but my 4-year-old does not. So I have learned just to, you know, cook it longer. Mm. Yeah, so...
Weird from a Promveer on Facebook. Promveer writes, my tuna sandwich never tastes as good as in the restaurant. Do you have any tips? Any ideas for jazzing up a tuna sandwich? Could you fruit in that like you do with a chicken salad?
When I do a tuna salad, I tend to steer more in the Mediterranean direction. So some nice olives, some good herbs, like such as a fresh oregano, but don't go overboard because oregano is very strong. And a good quality tuna. So something that is maybe kept not in water, but in oil. So you're going to have it's going to have a slightly different texture to it, and just a little bit less watery. And then just as in the chicken salad sandwich, if you can make your own mayonnaise, I think that's definitely preferable. You'll just get a lot more flavor out of the sandwich.
And what about what you serve on the side? So most of the times that's going to be potato chips, I guess, unless it's a diner kind of thing and you get french fries with it. What do you like on the side with a sandwich?
I like a side salad with a good punchy vinaigrette, especially if the sandwich is, has, you know, kind of fatty, such as a grilled cheese sandwich, which is basically, you know, butter, bread, cheese, butter, or bread, butter. So it's nice to have something acidic to mm-hmm. kind of cut that and kind of refresh your palate. So.
And what if we want to upgrade our sandwiches starting tomorrow, what are some good ingredients we want to have around that goes with a lot of things? You've mentioned fresh herbs a couple times, other things you like to have around just to add a little zest, a little extra something.
Sure, yeah. That's a good question. The good cheeses, so like I said, a soft cheese, a hard cheese, fresh herbs I think are just good to have in your pantry in general, and they're pretty easy to grow too at home, so and pretty abundant. Let's see here. I think if you can, like I've brought this up again, but making your own mayonnaise, it keeps pretty well. So having that on hand is always helpful. And obviously having a good loaf of bread. I'm I spoil myself with bread on a daily basis, but I do think that having that good quality loaf in your kitchen is very versatile, and you can use it in a number of different things, but sandwiches first and foremost.
Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Andrew Hutchinson is owner and head bread baker at Madison Sourdough, joining us on Food Friday to talk sandwiches. And you can find a bunch of those recipes we were discussing over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Taylor Swift there with Look What You Made Me Do, the first release from her upcoming album due out in November.
And there's been a lot of excitement about that new song dropping. Taylor Swift is the top-selling artist today, but people also get pretty hyped up about new music from Beyoncé. But we were thinking, other than Taylor Swift and Beyoncé, is that it? Do people still get excited about new music coming from other artists?
Yeah, I mean, my modus operandi is to get really into music that was super fresh 5 years ago or so. So I'm a late discoverer, late adapter of a lot of music. So it's pretty rare that there's something new coming out that I'm into.
Right, same here, and double that, what you just said for me in TV shows. I'm always into what everyone was watching 10 years ago. But yeah, I don't know. It's with having kids now. We've got kids, and once in a while they listen to Top 40 radio. And you know what? It is kind of exciting when new stuff comes out. But then I also find that same new stuff plays maybe 16 months later. It stays around.
There is one I was excited about out today also, the new Queens of the Stone Age album. That is a band that I like enough that I'm actually excited, and hopefully by the end of the weekend I will have checked it all out. And we'll go out with one of the tracks from Queens of the Stone Age, The Way You Used to Do, here on Central Time.